Last time on Culture File, we met Dan Jurafsky, a Stanford professor and foodie who's brought his interests together in research that traces food and language across the centuries. We're in the Persian heartlands of Mayfair, this time on a shopping trip with the professor in search of almond sweets and rose waters and the ancient roots of fish and chips.
What's this?
Fresh cream. What's it called?
Shokhaibiyah.
Yeah. And what's that?
That's vermicelli fresh cream as well. Ismailia.
Oh, it's beautiful. It looks delicious. I call this the grammar of cuisine. And this idea comes from structuralism, which is the origin of a lot of linguistic thought, that we have these implicit systems governing, you know, a language is an implicit set of rules that you don't think of explicitly. You know, why do I say, you know, determiners like the, why do they come before nouns? It's an implicit system that we just pick up and we learn. And I think food is the same way. There are these implicit rules about what makes a dish in different cuisines. So for example, in European and American food, meals end with dessert. We have this idea that at the end of a meal, the last dish should be something sweet. And this, we didn't always have this idea. Medieval cooking, there were sweet dishes all the way through the meal. There were, you could have rabbits and sugar and ginger, or you could have a stew of mutton with lemons and honey and so on. So this idea that sweet things really belong at the end, and that it's kind of ungrammatical to have sweet things in the middle or the beginning, really developed quite late, as the word dessert was borrowed into English from French very late, only in the last few hundred years. And that idea also, interestingly, seems to have come from Persia. So it looks like the French got it from the Spanish, and you can look at Moorish, you know, in Arabic, early cookbooks, 1300s, talking about the order of the meal, saying that, you know, it's proper to put the sweet thing at the end. Oh, there's some syrup. So here's your orange blossom water. So orange blossom, the original flavor for ice cream, which is a hint about why ice cream, how we know ice cream comes from the Middle East, is that the first flavors were in fact Middle Eastern flavors like orange blossom.
Which are water. Sort of reappearing as trendy ice cream flavors.
Exactly. So the latest hip ice cream flavor in San Francisco now is orange blossom. And it's really a throwback. I think about food as a scientific innovation. And we're really, social scientists are very interested in how innovation spreads. How is it that scientific ideas are borrowed? How do we make progress? You know, I'm a university professor. We think a lot about how do inventions happen? And food is a great example of this, because it's an invention that's very old. And we can study little details. How do recipes get borrowed from culture to culture? And it looks like the answer for food is very similar to the answer for other kinds of technology. In a lot of the work we've studied in the history of computer science, big ideas often come from neighboring fields. So a lot of the innovations in computer science come from electrical engineering. We borrowed some mathematics. We borrowed this particular variant of probability theory from electrical engineering in the 1980s, and then we adapted it in computer science, and we apply it now to computational linguistics. And it turns out that that's exactly what happened in food. And you can see that in the history of how sikbaj turned into fish and chips, or the history of the word ketchup. Any of these foods that morphed over time, it's as if it's the boundaries between cultures where innovation happens. And that's really a lesson for science as much as it is for food. Macaron, the earliest recipes for macaron came from marzipan recipes that had either rose water or orange blossom. And it was really a change in European cuisine as it's moving away from the Middle Eastern origins, the spices and the rose waters and the orange blossoms. This happened in the 17th century. It's in that change that you begin to instead start using the local European spices, the rosemaries and the thymes and the sages. Sikbaj was the favorite dish of the Sassanid Shahs of Persia. So think about 6th century Persia. You have these fabulous courts in Ctesiphon, the capital of Sassanid Persia of the time. And the Shah, his favorite dish, the Shah Khosrow, his favorite dish was this stew. And think of it as a sweet and sour stew. It had beef, and it had onions, and it had a lot of vinegar, and it had sugar, and sometimes there was other kinds of meats, chicken. It was a simmered stew with a sweet and sour flavor. That's these days, sweet and sour is very common. We have it in all sorts of things. But of course, at the time, sugar was very expensive, and vinegar took a while to make. And so it was an impressive, exotic dish. And all of the Shahs chefs knew how to make this dish, and it was mythologized, and it was put in the cookbooks. And so when the Abbasid Muslim empire took over that same region and established its capital in Baghdad, a formerly Persian-speaking region, they hired these same chefs. And this dish, sikbaj, this sweet and sour stew, became the favorite dish of the caliphs. And there's all these stories about this, kind of legends about this dish, how the caliph was smelled one day, the smell of this dish coming from a boat nearby on the canals, and he asked the sailor to bring him this dish, and it was so delicious that he filled the pot that the sikbaj came in with gold and sent it back to the sailor. And maybe because of these sailors, the dish metamorphosized. It turned into a fish dish, and you had these dishes of fried fish with vinegar and onions, and we have a recipe from the 1300s in Egypt, and then the recipe seems to be borrowed by the Christians and creep into Europe. You know, at this time, the Christian rules about fasting are much stricter than they are today, so you couldn't eat meat or dairy on Wednesdays and Fridays, and of course Lent, and so this idea of a fried fish dish and vinegar became very popular, and it spread from southern Italy up. It spread to Provence and southern France, and we have recipes in Catalonia and Spain. And so it was called something, it was called scabeche or skibaj or escabeche in Spain. So the name changed, and it was barred up into France, where the cold jelly of this dish was called alsikbaj or asikpikium in Latin, and then it became aspic. And then the dish metamorphosized in a number of really fabulous ways. So it gets into the Iberian Peninsula, and then the Spanish set out for Peru, and they meet there the Moche Indians, who ate a particular kind of raw fish flavored with chili, and that dish got somehow combined with this sour fish, fried fish and onions dish, and you ended up with what we now call ceviche, which presumably comes from this same root. Modern ceviche is a fish, raw fish that's cured in a lemon or lime juice with onions. And at the same time, the Jesuits left Portugal for Japan and established missions in Japan, and they brought a fried version of this food to Japan. And early Japanese cookbooks talk about this Portuguese food called tempura, which comes from a Portuguese word meaning seasoning. So it's a particular seasoned version of the dish, and that's the origin of tempura, the Japanese fried originally fish, but now of course vegetables and other things. And then at the same time, the Jews left the Iberian Peninsula. They end up via the Netherlands in London, where they bring their version of this fried fish dish. So by, for example, 1850, Dickens talks about the fried fish warehouses of the East End of London, and you see cookbooks in 1850 and 1860 talking about Jewish fried fish. And of course, as potatoes fried in drippings began to come into England, the two merged together, and this formerly kind of cold fried fish began to be eaten hot with potatoes, and that's the origin of fish and chips. So the same dish that was the favorite food of the 6th century has become the favorite foods of six nations, and every religion and culture has taken and added a little bit to each dish along the way.
I was shopping there with Dan Jurafsky, author of The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu, and next time we'll be looking at aspirational eating and the history of ketchup.